This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at weightwatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
This is the Fixer Sciatica Podcast.
So let's talk about piriformis injections, the piriformis muscle itself. Why is that so important? And the clinical criteria necessary to be even a candidate for an injection into piriformis, because I've been working with a fair amount of patients and clients lately where they're working with their professionals and everyone means well, but oftentimes when you're experiencing sciatic-like symptoms or pain along the sciatic nerve, one of the first things that people will look at will be the low back, but then not necessarily have the opportunity to look a little bit further down the chain. And the sciatic nerve actually is one of the longest nerves in the body. It runs all the way from our brain and down to our foot. And so there's a lot of different structures that can actually be impinging on the nerve itself. Failure to look at the piriformis is only going to pretty much stop the journey a lot sooner. Rather than me just, you know, talk to you listeners just about piriformis, we're talking about piriformis injections with Dr. Arun Kalava, who was actually a guest a couple weeks ago where we talked about stellate ganglion blocks, and he was very kind enough to take the time out of his day to share his experience with this type of intervention. So Dr. Kalava, so great to see you, and thank you so much for being back on the show.
Yes, thank you, Ashley, for having me on the show. I'm looking forward to talking about piriformis syndrome and what interventions are available and what could somebody do in diagnosing and getting treatments that are available and which are effective, rather than just going around and figuring out themselves, you know, what this syndrome is and, you know, where to seek help.
Absolutely, because there's a lot of different professionals along the treatment spectrum in regards to lower extremity pain. And before we get into it, for the listeners who might have met you for the first time, just tell us a little bit more about your clinic out in Tampa.
So my name is Arun Kalava. I'm a pain physician. Actually, I'm an anesthesiologist by trade. Then I did a fellowship in acute pain at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. I've been in private practice for the last 6 years, where I primarily focus on peripheral nerve pain and musculoskeletal pain. To the less, you know, lesser extent, the low back and neck pain, which most pain doctors would. So I usually take care of everything else other than the spine. So that's where we're talking about piriformis, wherein, you know, spine is not the reason why somebody would have piriformis syndrome. So that's where I come in.
So let's talk a little bit more about the piriformis itself. People have probably heard about it via the internet as they're going through the searches, piriformis syndrome. Let's talk about the piriformis specifically. And interestingly enough, it's a pretty small muscle, but it has a huge role in a lot of our function as bipedal animals. We're walking, but that also impacts how we're sitting too. So tell us a little bit more about that.
So the muscle itself is under the gluteus maximus. Again, we have three glutes, as you know. Most people know we have a big butt or the glutes. It lies under the glutes completely. Glutes are very big muscles, as we already know. A little string-like muscle that starts or originates from the sacrum and then travels across the buttock and then goes and attaches to the upper part of the femur close to the greater trochanter. Again, not close to the hip joint. So that's why people with piriformis syndrome can come with buttock pain or, you know, hip pain or sciatic.
Yeah, and interesting enough, muscle in relation to the rest of your glute muscles, it's actually not a very big muscle, but it does have a huge role in regards to movement. And so when I'm looking at the piriformis muscle as a physical therapist, I'm trying to determine, is the piriformis operating well? Is it operating efficiently? And for you listeners out there, the role of the piriformis muscle is going to be the following. One is what we call lateral rotation of the hip. So it's like if you were looking at your thigh and your knee and your foot turn out, that is what we call lateral rotation or external rotation. And ideally that muscle, the piriformis, does this motion when the leg is extended or in the neutral position. We also look at hip abduction, was bringing the leg out to the side when the hip is flexed. It also helps with some tilting of the pelvis side to side, but primarily it helps by stabilizing the pelvis into more of a neutral position. And so listeners, when it comes to pelvic position, again, we're looking at the various different chains of what could be irritating the sciatic nerve or the sources of sciatic nerve. Well, we have our low back, we have our pelvis, which is actually the area that sits pretty much at the level of your hips. And then we have your glutes, and then we move a little bit farther down. And so there's many different areas in which this nerve can actually be irritated. So that's why we're talking about something like this. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the various different interventions. Now, we've come across a lot of different piriformis stretches and strengthening exercises, which we'll talk a little bit later in this episode. But the main thing that I wanted to ask you about is the injections into the piriformis. And so it's a pretty intense or a very localized procedure. So tell us a little bit more about what a piriformis injection is. Are there different types of compounds that can be injected? And then also the criteria of how you can actually determine
we'll answer that question, but I want to just touch base a little bit upon the piriformis syndrome itself as to what the presentations could be when somebody walks into the clinic. According to literature we have, there is a 6% chance that a sciatica could be piriformis syndrome. Okay, 6% of the patients with sciatica actually have piriformis syndrome. It's more common in females. Apparently, it's more common, and that's what I see in my office. It's unilateral in the sense it affects mostly one side, not both sides. We do see occasionally both sides affected. And it can be triggered by trauma, long sitting, bicycle riding, fibrosis, or tumor, and infection, right? So all these things can trigger these, you know, sciatica symptoms. So we just need to know what they are. And a lot of the times, we can diagnose either clinically plus using an MRI of the pelvis where we look at the muscle. And majority of the patients usually have had an MRI the lumbar spine, but never the pelvis. So if the lumbar spine is either negative or doesn't seem to contribute to the sciatica, we have a high index of suspicion for piriformis syndrome. Then we would do the physical examination in the office where I'm like, okay, I'm going to push on the area of pain, usually where people put their wallet. It's called where the wallet is. The pain is like right where my wallet would be in the back pocket. I'll press on the area and most people will have pain. And some of the patients will also say, if I use my commode, go to poop or pee, I will sit on the commode and the pressure will relieve and then I'm feeling better because there's no pressure on this sciatic nerve. Also, there's anatomical variations with these presentations. So MRI could be an important tool because sciatic nerve is supposed to be under the piriformis. In a small percentage of patients, it goes through the piriformis and can lie on top of the piriformis. Then the treatment would also differ and vary. So a pelvic MRI might be an important tool in identifying what the therapeutic interventions would be. Now, when it comes to therapeutic interventions, as you mentioned, we only start these after, you know, they had failed conservative therapy. Like, what is conservative therapy? Heat, cold, whatever that might work. Physical therapy, at least 6 weeks or, you know, 8 weeks. Stretching, they've tried oral medications like Tylenol, ibuprofen, have tried muscle relaxants. All these haven't worked. Then I would start looking into doing injections. Now, what injections are performed? Primarily, we do two injections. One is injection of local anesthetic with or without steroid. In my practice, I do not use steroid for muscles because we don't have enough data to support that use of steroid would help a muscle. Like a lot of times we do get a cortisone shot, right? If there is inflammation, but I don't know if the muscle is inflamed, right? It's tight, we know that. But if tightness should not be addressed by cortisone, so that's the rationale of not using a corticosteroid. So we usually use a numbing medicine wherein patient gets numbing medicine injected with a needle under ultrasound guidance. Again, there is multiple ways of injecting. You can do blind, not very reliable because there could be a big butt, small butt, right? So different people have different butt sizes. So anatomically, you might be injecting in the wrong place. So the best way to do this is ultrasound guided. So make sure you have a provider who would use ultrasound. Or you can go into hospital and have a CT, which is computer tomography, CT-guided injections too, which are very, very precise because the muscle is so thin. We have so much buttock fat, then the glutes are big muscles. This is literally a string of muscle going through. So you want to be going to a place where they can precisely do the injections. Otherwise, the injection most likely will not work. You go through a procedure with no benefit out of it. Or you just, you lose the, or you miss the diagnosis. Like, hey, I don't have piriformis, when you actually have it because you didn't get the injection in the right place. Now, the lidocaine will usually serve as a diagnostic tool. We're in a pretty much a gold standard. If I do the injection of local anesthetic into the piriformis and the patient report 2 to 4 hours of relief, we know the muscle's relaxed and then the pain symptoms have gone down significantly, which is more than 50% reduction in symptoms severity, then we would say the patient certainly has piriformis syndrome, and we'll give them the option of getting botulinum toxin or Botox, as people know, which, you know, millions of people use it for aesthetic purposes, headaches, spasticity. There's different indications for Botox. So this is one of the indications for Botox, and there seems to be a significant amount of evidence of the efficacy of Botox in piriformis syndrome. You want me to tell you about my experience in the clinic in the last 5 years with Botox?
Yes, but before we get into that, you brought up clinical presentation and imaging. And we were talking earlier before we started recording about how we want to be able to treat the patient. So it's a combination of both MRI findings and clinical presentations. And so let's talk a little bit more about the clinical presentations of this piriformis syndrome, because through my experience, like working with patients who dealt with sciatica and piriformis syndrome and the interchangeability of it, what I actually really found, because I look at, well, what is the, where's the sciatic nerve and how does it actually innervate? And what's interesting is the fact that the sciatic nerve actually doesn't innervate the piriformis. And so, and whether it be the piriformis or the glutes, the nerves that actually innervate or supply the sensation to that area are going to be the superior and inferior gluteal nerves. And so what's really interesting was the fact that I know in my job and when I'm working with patients, I'm trying to figure out, is it going to be a spine-related thing or is it going to be really more pelvis and piriformis? And so what I found from a clinical presentation is the fact that usually patients who are dealing with the sciatica or lumbar radiculopathy, you're having back pain with associated symptoms, which goes into the hamstring and then also the lower leg. And usually if it is true lumbar radiculopathy, or for the most part, it kind of skips the butt if it's addressing like the whole sciatic nerve, because again, the sciatic nerve doesn't supply that area. So if that's the case, if it kind of skips the butt, it makes me think, okay, let me hone in a little bit more on the back to see how we can influence it. And then from there, I actually have my patients go through flexion, extension, side bending, and rotation to see if any of those spinal motions actually influence the pain that they're experiencing. From there, if in the event that the patient does have glute pain or butt pain, specifically the piriformis, I think, okay, maybe this muscle could be affected, but I still have to go back and see, is the lumbar spine, is the back actually having any sort of role? And so I'm trying to determine flexion, extension, side bending, rotation, if any of those actually influence the glute itself. But then I also look at, well, you said before, when they're putting weight pressure on the glute muscle itself, whether it be sitting, could that actually be the actual shear pressure on the piriformis? So I look at, okay, if I'm having patient having glute pain, it's like, okay, let's look at this other area. And especially if it's like a localized glute pain, I often find for me personally, if I see a patient who has glute pain and lower extremity radicular symptoms, and again, no changes with spinal motions, it's like, okay, let me move down the chain a little bit more and address hip and pelvis position. Do you find anything different with the patients that you see?
I think, as you said, if they don't have any symptom worsening with your spine motion, most likely it's not coming from the spine. I agree completely with that. Whatever findings you mentioned, I see them in the office when they present to me. And unfortunately, they've already seen many doctors or pain physicians before they come to my door, because it's pretty much a diagnosis of exclusion at that point. They've had injections to the spine, they have epidural shots, maybe a caudal epidural, yeah. And maybe have had an injection in the buttock, but was done either blind, just by a feel, or using x-ray guidance. For anybody who knows what an x-ray shows us anything metal, anything that's bone, right? It doesn't show us muscles. It doesn't show. So to be 100% sure, you want to make sure it's done under ultrasound guidance or a CT guidance in the hospitals, so you don't miss the diagnosis. Because they're like, oh, I did have the injection. And then I would ask them, hey, did you have it under any guidance? Was it x-ray, ultrasound? Then the history comes out like, well, somebody might have missed, so let's just go back and redo the procedure, unfortunately. But just be, you know, aware that you have to ask and, you know, advocate for yourselves as to, hey, how are you doing this? You know, I heard this is better. Can we do it this way? You know, or should you or show me somebody who does it that way?
You brought up when patients, say, experience or receive multiple, say, spinal injections. And I've seen this across my years of treating patients where they've been getting a lot of physician intervention from a spine standpoint. And say, for example, they do get an epidural, but most of the time, epidurals that they do get is that diagnostic local anesthetic and then the steroid itself. And what I found to be interesting is that, and this is just what I've observed, is that there's some patients who get this spinal injection with the local anesthetic and like momentarily it actually does experience relief. But then a few days later, they go back to square one. And I'm just going to share with you like what my theory is on this, and you let me know if this makes sense. But especially when they're injecting into the epidural space, it's kind of addressing like all of the nerves at that specific level. And so if you are even having nerve irritation, even at the level of the piriformis, when you're doing a local anesthetic at that specific nerve root, it kind of addresses all the sensation or pain sensations at that level, which may give us a false positive. But I'm not an expert in this, but that's kind of how I would rationalize it in regards to this is where I'm thinking. And again, I'm not going to tell patients like what interventions they get. That's your role. But that was an interesting observation I made where if they're injecting at a specific spinal level, it would also address the corresponding nerve roots that exit the spine. Does that make sense?
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1.
Medications require eligibility and prescription. Patients on 15 milligrams of tirzepatide had an average of 21% weight loss in a 72-week clinical trial when paired with diet and exercise. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Is that...
Yes, I mean, it obviously makes sense because piriformis is causing what we call a pseudo-sciatica, right? That's what it's also called, a pseudo-sciatica. It's a false sciatica. So that means I'm getting symptoms not from the muscle, but from the compression of the sciatic nerve. But if the nerve is numb because I got an epidural shot, obviously my symptoms will disappear. But my problem, which is the tight muscle, stays the same. The moment the nerve signals return after the numbing medicine wears off, the symptoms are back again. Right? So if they did that and then they put the steroid as well and that did not give them relief, then we would think of, okay, we got to look down. And as you said, you know, I think clinical examination is key. If somebody really pinpoints and say, takes a finger and say, it's right here, doc, in the middle center of my buttock, where I put my wallet, then you're like, okay, maybe this person has for piriformis. We should do some stretch tests, you know, figure out, getting a pelvic MRI, see what's happening, and maybe do a diagnostic injection to the piriformis muscle. But I totally agree with your point. If the nerve is numb, obviously the symptoms will disappear because the nerve is sensing and nerve is what's causing all the symptoms. But the cause of the nerve symptoms are a tight muscle or sometimes fibrosis of the muscle itself.
So let's talk about this concept of tight, because oftentimes tightness is something that patients feel. And oftentimes piriformis muscle or muscles in general can feel tight either when they're truly in a shortened position, and that's what a lot of people associate it, but also tightness can be felt when the muscle is stretched significantly. And you said the majority of the patients that you've seen in your clinic dealing with piriformis syndrome are most likely female. And usually when I'm looking at that anatomically, a female's knees have a tendency to buckle in, especially when walking and standing. So for them, that muscle is a little bit more on the stretch side, is on in a perpetual stretched position. And so when it comes to injections, and then on the other end, so like say, for example, mostly males, will deal mostly with like a true tight and shortened muscle, because they often kind of sit out in that position as well. It's like the exact opposite of the knee buckling. So when it comes to interventions like the use of Botox, do you find that the outcomes are similar in regards to injecting or providing this intervention to patients who have what is called a true shortened piriformis versus like an actual like perpetually lengthened piriformis?
Good point. You brought in the tightness or the more relaxed, thinner muscle. Again, females, you know, physically they will have a smaller bulk of any muscle, right? Until unless they are bodybuilders, and males will have a thicker proponent of that muscle. Now, there are bodybuilders, or sometimes people do have hypertrophy wherein that muscle itself has become larger than normal because either they work their glutes and the piriformis while they're working out, or the way they stand or their work might have, you know, over decades just became hypertrophy. So the ultrasound will give us an idea as to whether the muscle is shortened, you know, when it comes to length. Is it thicker? Is it thinner? Is there fibrosis in there? So the MRI can also give us some clues. When it comes to treating Botox, females and males seem to be responding pretty similarly. In the last 5 to 6 years, I've been treating piriformis. And what Botox does is irreversibly, again, I'm mentioning the word again, irreversibly, there's no reversing the action of Botox. It causes irreversible blockage of the acetylcholine receptors, which is required for muscle contraction. So this muscle, we're assuming it's contracted, shortened. Now we're putting Botox to relax it. So it irreversibly blocks those receptors. So a lot of the patients will never see me again. One injection and they're gone. And I probably have seen only once or twice because either the medication was inadequate in them. So we usually go by the size of the muscle on the ultrasound. On average, females and males get about 50 units, you know, because of the size of the muscle. If the patient gets partial response, we go double the dose. And a lot of studies have done it 100 units, which is, you know, but again, the cost of the medicine is high. And I don't like to put more medicine than that is required. You know what I mean? You can always inject more, you know what I mean? But if you give too much, is it necessary? Maybe that will affect the hip stability, you know what I mean? Because it's a major hip stabilizer, the piriformis muscle. So MRI seems to be very helpful in trying to see, okay, does this person have a sciatic nerve which actually goes through the muscle, which is very uncommon again, but it does occur. Or is it going from the top where the buttock itself, the glute muscles is pressing on the sciatic. So those are the things to delineate. They're very uncommon, but we do see them here and there.
Thank you for sharing that. And you brought up the pelvic positioning. And so as we've been talking about in this show, the piriformis is a hip and pelvis stabilizer. So things to be looking out for if you are possibly dealing with this like glute, localized glute piriformis pseudosciatica. And this is something I see clinically in my practice is that if you have a tendency to be what we call an anterior pelvic tilt. So if your low back is a little bit more arched and your pelvis is kind of rotated forward. And ideally, when that happens, we have most likely tight hip flexors, tight and irritated piriformises as well. Also, if you are standing and your hip is pushing out to one side, usually for the most part, if your hip is pushing out to one side, you're stretching out that piriformis muscle, putting a lot of pressure on that area. And the third piece, and this is something I noticed recently, especially in the CrossFit world. In CrossFit, we are often taught to push our knees out when we're squatting. And the role of the piriformis is to actually externally rotate and abduct our thighs when the hip is flexed. And the majority of the time when you're at the bottom of the squat. So in some cases, if you're pushing too aggressively, you can actually result in that. I'm glad that you brought up, Dr. Kalava, the hypertrophy of the piriformis as well, which can also impact that. And so really when it comes to trying to even have long-lasting changes post-intervention, we're looking at trying to keep your pelvis nice and even. And what's the pelvis? It's going to be that area that sits right below your belly button. It kind of houses your bladder. And I want you to imagine when it comes to positioning is that your pelvis is like a bowl. You want the bowl to be flat, pointing straight up, because the moment that that pelvis starts to tip forward, that bowl tips forward, you're going to start leaking a lot of water. It puts a lot of tension on a lot of unnecessary structures, but it also means that we have to avoid overcorrecting, which is going to be in that super posterior pelvic tilt. So we want to be able to keep everything nice and level. So let's talk a little bit more about the kind of like the recovery process. I know that patients usually don't see you. So once they get the injection, is it something where they have to hold off on activity? Are they like, should they resume physical therapy? What are some things that they should be focusing on to ensure that, you know, they don't have to come back and see you again?
So for a diagnostic injection, the instructions are slightly different versus the therapeutic injection, which is using Botox. So patient comes in, we do have a diagnosis, you know, a high likelihood of piriformis syndrome. We'll go ahead and say, we're going to do this. Now, their instructions will depend on the site. If it's the right side, you cannot drive. If it's the left side, you might be able to drive because you will need your right. But since your sciatic nerve controls a lot of your motor function in the leg, the numbing medicine, the piriformis, can slowly seep in and cause tingling numbness or at times weakness of the leg. So it's not safe to drive, obviously, if it's in the right side, but the left side as well. So we usually say, please have somebody come with you for this appointment, irrespective of the side. Because let's say we do the left side and the patient's like, oh, my legs feels funny because obviously the sciatic nerve is numb now from the numbing medicine reaching there. Not all the time, but a lot of the time we do see that happening. I always warn them, like, you might have some tingling numbness, but we're looking at for the pain in that buttock area. Like, if I press on it after the injection, do you have pain or not? You know what I mean? Are you able to sit longer? That's the key, relax the muscle. So they cannot drive for obvious reasons. It's probably advisable to get a crutch or something to hold on, a walking stick, just to be safe, irrespective of that. Now, that's the diagnostic. When it comes to therapeutic injections, since Botox does not numb the sciatic nerve, it only relaxes the muscle, we usually say you can get the injection and you can drive home and take it easy for that day. The injection soreness obviously can last a day or two. I wouldn't do any strenuous activities for a week or two, but the Botox peak effect is about 3 to 4 weeks. So we usually say you might see a slow gradual progression towards maximal benefit from the Botox at 3 weeks. But in the meantime, activity is tolerated, nothing strenuous. I wouldn't go do deadlifts and, you know, squats and stuff, but just normal walking and no major running. You can go for a short run, but not do a marathon or half a marathon. Otherwise, the recovery is very simple. It's a small injection, so recovery from any injection is the same. But as I said, surprisingly, most patients do not have to do any more interventions if they respond to it. There is a small percentage of patients who do not respond to Botox injection. I'm saying very small. The reason why is that they might have a pathology in the sense the muscle is fibrotic. There is no muscle per se, it's strings of fibrous tissue, right? So if I put Botox, it has nowhere to act. I'm just a fibrous band of muscle sitting on the sciatic. In those cases, obviously the medicine will not work, and we'll say surgery might be an option to talk to the surgeons. Surgery is always the last option if everything has failed. Make sure you fail therapies wherein these procedures are done with either CT guidance, ultrasound guidance. It was placed precisely, the right amount was placed by the right physician out there. And then you, like, because surgery itself can cause scarring and you might still have the problem after the surgery is done because we all heal with scar. You divide or cut the piriformis. Now the scarring will push on the sciatic nerve. Now your symptoms are back. A repeat surgery. So it's just a vicious cycle in some of these patients, unfortunately. But you just have to be very careful if you want to proceed with surgical options.
We appreciate you sharing that. For the listeners out there who are just trying to, you know, find answers for their pain. And they might think, it might be actually truly my piriformis. What do you think are the best ways for patients to truly advocate for themselves? Because obviously, usually spine doctors and orthopedists are going to be looking primarily at the spine. And so how can patients communicate effectively to say, hey, maybe let's look at a different site because these interventions might not have worked? Or is it it's the clinician that would actually identify that as well. What are some tools that we can give to the patients or the listeners?
Very good question, Ashley. So I think the onus is on both the patient and the doctor, right? So you have to be as involved in your care as the doctor is as well. And giving the doctor proper symptom diary, proper feedback is very important as well. So the physician on the other end can think outside the box or think of something other than normal. This is, again, 94% of the time, the sciatica comes from the spine. 6% of the time, it's the piriformis. There is less than 1 in 10 chance of somebody having a piriformis if they have sciatica. We have to look at the odds and say, common things are common, uncommon things are uncommon, but they do exist. So reviewing the MRI with your doctor and say, doc, do you really think this is the cause? Because I do have buttock pain. You know, I think pointing them to, like, okay, I have pain when I sit. Just the sitting is bothersome. I can't sit. Giving them a proper history might, you know, help them out in trying to diagnose you earlier than later. Just saying, well, I have pain in the back. I mean, sometimes it's difficult to give a proper history to, right? Because the symptoms are diffuse. Like, I can feel it everywhere. I don't know where it's coming from. But yeah, I mean, making sure they're examining you, like, doc, did you make sure you examined? You know, you can ask them, like, hey, you didn't put a hand on me. How do you know I have something? Because my MRI shows something. Maybe we should do the exam if they are not doing it. So being, you know, your own advocate is important. I think a lot of times I do get a third of the patients where the physical therapist say, it doesn't look like it's your spine. As you said, I'm doing rotation, you know, all the motions in the spine, not reproducible or not worsening. So maybe you should look into piriformis. Then I'm like, okay, maybe you should get an MRI of the pelvis at that point. So that's what the patient should do.
Great tools. And then you brought up one note is pain when sitting. Oftentimes when patients tell me that they have pain with sitting, I would often actually ask them, do you feel a difference on various different sitting surfaces? Because when you're sitting on a toilet, your pressure is very, very different compared to when you're sitting on a hard bench, compared to very different if you're sitting on a bar stool, right? And even on a couch. And so I think it's very important, especially if you are experiencing pain when sitting, that your practitioners actually see how you sit as well, because it's we can determine, like, are we dealing with spinal flexion, which often happens in sitting, or are we actually putting pressure on your piriformis itself? And so it gives us some really good clues. Dr. Kalava, I mean, as always, you're brilliant, and this is all very useful information. You have a clinic out in Tampa, which patients can see you at. Tell us a little bit more about your clinic and how people can get in touch.
Our clinic's name is Tampa Pain MD. So we have a website by tampapainmd.com. We have a phone number on the website, which you can reach out to, which is 813-533-6259, or email us on the link on the website, and we'll get in touch with you. We usually can get patients in within a week, so that shouldn't be a problem. But as you mentioned, actually, about the sitting, a lot of these patients don't even sit when they see me because they cannot sit for even 2 minutes. So I think that's a big giveaway for the patients. I'm not able to sit for 2 minutes. Maybe it's the piriformis. You know what I mean? They all talk to me standing. I stand and do the whole visit because they can't sit. It's uncomfortable. They're just telling me I cannot sit. So should we look in the piriformis? Yeah, most likely we'll find some answers there.
Listeners, if you did not got a chance to write that down, I'm going to go ahead and put all that information into the show notes. Dr. Kalava, it's been such a pleasure and honor to be interviewing you about this topic where a lot of people are actually experiencing a lot of pain and issues, and I'm excited for it to help a lot of people.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here, Ashley. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you got some help from today's podcast. And for more info, check us out at ifixyoursciatica.com. Have a fantastic and pain-free day. No patient-therapist relationship is formed by listening to this podcast. We are not providing medical advice, and all information should be confirmed by a medical provider.